And the chair is due in the Transportation Committee, so he's going to head that way. But we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2566. And first up is Representative Haas. I'll go to Transportation. I'll go back.
Please state your name for the record.
Representative Mark Haas, House District 57. Thank you for indulging me today. I will tell you that I got into this bill because of constituents, some of whom you know the story about former Representative Montgomery, who was a respected member of this this legislature. His grandson died of a sudden heart attack at Beaverton swimming pool. There were four lifeguards, two physicians, including a cardiac surgeon who attended him and couldn't save him. The physicians did say, had there been a defibrillator handy, there was a very good chance they could have. And so his father, Claire Jones, has made this part of his life's obsession now. And I've become a part of his obsession and gone to events where defibrillators are being promoted. They're in most golf courses in this state, for example, but it's not uncommon for people to get up to a microphone at one of these events and say, "Hi, my name is Ben Westland, and 6 months ago I died. But thanks to the groundskeeper at Heron Lakes Golf Course, I'm back on the story." And I just think that these things are becoming kind of the fire extinguisher of our time, that they do save lives, and they're proven to be lifesavers. And just like fire extinguishers, they're seldom used, but when they are used, they're very effective. So our goal here with this bill is to get them into Oregon high schools. We have an amendment to the bill you have there, which will replace most of the language and essentially allow the Department of Education the ability to set up somewhat of a receptacle so they can apply for federal aid and for private donations from foundations that fund defibrillator, putting defibrillators in schools and public buildings. And no state money will be used, but it is important to command and direct the Department of Education to look for this federal money so that we can at least get started that way. The amendments are not ready yet. This committee is so far ahead of the game that they're even holding hearings before the amendments are already fully drafted. So I just ask that you would adopt those amendments if you're ready, and send this on to the Ways and Means Committee where they can splash holy water on it and succeed from there. There are some very smart people here from the Heart Association and Department Pediatrician Society who can speak to this too. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Representative
Elton. Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Haas, do you have a kind of an indication of what it might cost to have the ideal rollout in all high schools?
Well, they have dropped in price significantly down to about $1,500 a piece. So you just multiply by the numbers that you would need in as many high schools as possible, and there's your number.
Thank you.
Representative Westland.
That was my question as well.
Any other questions?
Representative Anderson. Madam Chair, you... Look, I'll ask you later. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Committee. Appreciate it.
Alicia Philpott, John Valley, Bob Seward.
Oh, you bring them on.
Bob Seward?
No, I'm John Dow.
Bob Seward? Fine.
There's something, so he wants to come up.
Okay. Identify yourself, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Alicia Philpott, Executive Director of the Oregon Pediatric Society. Dr. Jim Lace wanted to be here today, but he is doing hospital rounds, so I won't speak technically, but just wanted to say that we believe the bill has utility, although we want to emphasize the importance of a strong public education and training effort involved. Certainly are in support of the proposed amendments. We haven't seen them technically, but in support of the concept. And so also with the understanding that there are possibly federal funds available to assist in that funding, then we would be happy to work with the sponsors on the measure.
Great. Thank you.
Good morning, Vice Chair. Tomei, I had written, Chairman Carrizo, my written testimony. He's not here. Members of the committee, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is John Valley, and I am the Oregon Director for the Oregon Advocacy Director for the American Heart Association. I'm here today to speak on HB 2566. Sudden cardiac arrest kills an estimated 222,000 people a year. Most of these individuals will die because of a cardiac rhythm disturbance called ventricular fibrillation, which causes the heart to quiver uselessly. The only treatment for ventricular fibrillation is prompt defibrillation. Right now, approximately 5% survive a cardiac arrest. A strong chain of survival can increase this to as much as 20%. There are four critical links in the chain of survival. One, early access to an emergency system through a 911 system. Two, early CPR or cardiopulmonary resuscitation. Three, early defibrillation, use of an automated external defibrillator or an AED. Four, early advanced life support. HB 2566 will direct the State Department of Education to award grants to school districts and public charter schools to provide AEDs in public school facilities. When AED programs are developed in a community, the American Heart Association recommends priority development of programs that are most likely to have the greatest effect on survival from cardiac arrest. This program prioritization requires careful site selection, physician prescription, program supervision, training, and retraining of expected rescuers and CPR, and use of the AED. A planned system of response with frequent opportunities to practice, a link with local emergency medical services, and an ongoing system for monitoring quality improvement. It is our hope that the department will take all these factors into consideration when implementing the AED program described under HB 2566. When grants are given for the specific purpose of establishing an AED program in a school, priority should be given to schools that are farthest from emergency medical service response, have the lowest student population, and are used as community gathering sites on that spot, or that sponsor large student adult gatherings such as football games. High schools generally should be given a higher priority than elementary schools. We would encourage that the department adopt such a criteria as they go through the decision-making process of awarding grants under HB 2566. Therefore, we support HB 2566 as it increases access to one of the links in the chain of survival to survive a cardiac arrest. And I'd be happy to answer any questions members of the committee may have. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Valley. Any questions?
A lot of my question from before. Thank you, Madam Chairman. You say that there will be no state funds, but this is coming from the Department of Education.
Representative Vanderin and Chairman Tomei, as I understand it, the amendments that Representative Hass has spoken of, which aren't printed yet, are going to direct federal funds to the Department of Education to award those grants. How specifically the department chooses to administer and implement that program, I'm not sure if those federal grant funds would also help establish paying for that half-time employee, for example, to administer those programs as part of the granting process. I haven't seen the language.
Follow-up question?
Follow-up.
Thank you. I would assume that this might be beneficial also to teachers in the school who probably are a little bit more likely to have heart problems than a teenager. Do you have any idea how many teachers or students have required this, say, over the last year or 5 years? Is there any study that tells us there's a great need in the school?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I am not aware of any specific studies that have been done in Oregon to determine how many people in our public schools have had cardiac arrest. From the perspective of the American Heart Association, we feel that, and I think as I indicated in the testimony, that obviously if we were going through a criteria of where to award these grants to distribute these AEDs, that where more people are concentrated and where older people also are part of those gatherings. And we would encourage the department to look at high schools more closely than elementary schools because of that reason and the teachers. And I think the department may have some sort of study, but I'm not aware of it. And I believe there might be someone from the department testifying on that, so they may be able to answer that question myself.
Any other questions for Mr. Valley? Thank you.
Madam Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Bob Seward. I'm an associate superintendent of curriculum instruction at the Oregon Department of Education. I'm here to support this bill, and I have brought with me Andrea Morgan, who's done some research on the costs and the rollout of this grant program. You may want to invite her to the table for that, those answer your questions about that. Representative Anderson, we do not have an official study of the number of children that may have heart attacks or have had heart attacks in schools. However, I have a long history in special education. I do know that we do have records of children who have severe health impairments that could result in the need for a defibrillator. And that would probably be one of the criteria that we would use to roll out, make sure we get defibrillators in schools where children are known to have a condition that might result in that.
Any questions? Thank you. Ms. Morgan?
Chair and committee, I'm Andrea Morgan. I'm an education specialist in the Office of Curriculum and Instruction. And I've been doing some research about the rollout of this program. Most of the research has been done on the original version of the bill. So we'll need to translate that into smaller numbers if the amendments make it so it's just high schools. But as it was with 198 school districts, and that doesn't include charter schools or any private schools or public alternative schools, we were figuring that probably the cost would be somewhere around $3,795,000 to place one in every single school in the state. If we were going for two per district, as is original writing of the bill, we're figuring it's going to be somewhere around $1,260,000. That's on a cost of about $3,000 per unit. Now, we found that there's a variety of prices on these units, and it really depends on who you go to find out how much they're going to cost. What we're finding, too, is that new technology seems to be making the price go down. And so, much like your laptop computer 10 years ago, what did it cost? Same thing has gone on with these automatic defibrillators. We figured that it costs about $3,000, even though the unit itself may be somewhere around $2,000, simply because there is training required. Now, if you buy from the Red Cross, we reported that the training comes along with the unit, and their units cost more than the ones where you pay for the training separately. And so we figured that training alone is probably going to be in the range of about $600 for each school that will have one of these in place, because you have to have people that are trained and certified, just as you would with CPR. Where CPR has your ABCs, we now simply add a D, defibrillation. And so that training is necessary, although the units are pre-foolproof anymore, giving direct instruction to the person that's going to be using it. Also, an expense that would go along with the unit, and it depends on how the district would decide to do this. If it is required by federal and state law that they have the prescription for the unit, basically, that there is a physician that is responsible for the unit, making sure that it's maintained and making sure that all the paperwork is done, the batteries are charged, and doing monthly checks just to make sure that the unit is ready to go. Depending on how it's done, private companies offer the service for about $100 a year to do this. Others have been able to contract with a local physician to have them provide that service. But the main thing is that there is a cost to the maintenance of the unit, simply to make sure that the paperwork required is kept up to date and that the unit is functioning as it should. Also with this, we know that there will be upkeep costs that we'll have to be thinking about. Batteries will need to be replaced. Most of the units have about a five-year life for batteries, and the cost of the batteries range from about $75 kerosene stuff to $50. Batteries are required for that particular unit. Also, we know that the electrode pads that actually go on the patient have to be replaced about every 5 years, and that adds about another $175 every 5 years in maintenance with the process as well. So we're figuring that as originally written, it would cost about $1,260,000 to roll out the program. That's for the machines, the equipment, the things going to the school. It would take about a half-time person to administer the grant from the Department of Education. I think those are the expenses that would be incurred. If we take it just to high schools, there's around 300 high schools in the state of Oregon. And so that would, of course, cut the cost considerably if all we were going to do is get these for high schools.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Just a comment,
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If any of the committee is interested, we do have a defibrillator, at least one. We may have more here. And they're really easy to learn how to use. And if you'd like to be trained, I'm sure you could get Dr. Bates or myself to help you with that.
Great. Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Thank you. That's it. There will be amendments coming, I'm assuming. So with that, we will close public hearing on House Bill 2566. And we will open a public hearing on HJM 2. Representative Nelson. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Cruz. Chair Cruz and distinguished colleagues and committee members, thank you for this opportunity to appear before you today to speak to the need for House Joint Memorial 2. House Joint Memorial 2 was drafted on behalf of the 367,000 men and women in the state of Oregon who have dedicated their lives, risked their lives, and their future to preserve our precious freedom and secure for others a like opportunity for liberty around the world. In 2002, some 63,000 veterans received their health care from VA facilities in Oregon. We are most grateful for the three major medical centers in Portland, Roseburg, and White City, and for the community-based outpatient clinics in Bend and Salem and at Camp Relia on the Oregon coast. Statistics show the VA had over 12,000 inpatient admissions in 2001 and 636,168 outpatient visits in 2001, an increase of 100,000 more than in 2000. In conjunction with its major academic partner, the Oregon Health and Science University, we now have the only in-house VA liver transplant program west of the Mississippi River, with the first transplant performed in April 2002. Liver and kidney failure are common life-threatening problems among older veterans. Over 37% of the veteran population is 65 years old or older, compared with 13% of the general population. In Oregon, the VA cared for 26,490 veterans aged 65 and older in 2001. We are most grateful for the vast array of research on some of the most difficult challenges facing medical science today that the VA is conducting. The Portland Medical Center is the leading VA research institution for the state of Oregon and ranked first among VA medical centers in total VA research funding in 2002. While we recognize these fine accomplishments and the strong commitment of our Oregon VA staff, we must recognize we have an opportunity to correct a critical issue impacting the lives of our veterans. That is the extra burden and cost involved in the requisite transportation to our VA facilities for medical care when such care is available near the veterans' homes or where they exist, as nearly one-third of Oregon's homeless people are veterans. Today, we ask you to support this House Joint Memorial in our request to Congress to evaluate the efficiency and economics of our current veterans care system and to allow them to access facilities and professional treatment at local medical centers close to their families and home sites. This allowance will further eliminate the many hours of travel and waiting that is most often the case in seeking assistance of a VA facility. A recent example in Yamhill County, where I reside, which will express this issue concisely, relates to a veteran who could have received care at his local Newburgh Hospital for less than $200, but was required to be taken by ambulance to the Portland VA facility and later received an invoice for over $1,200. A recent national survey has found more than 300,000 veterans on wait lists to get routine appointments or who are waiting more than 6 months to see a doctor. The number of users receiving the VA's health care has risen dramatically in recent years, increasing nationally from 2.9 million in 1995 to 4.4 million in 2002. An additional 600,000 veterans are projected to enroll in VA health care this year, and this dramatic increase was not anticipated by the VA. While access to care has been on a first-come, first-served basis, new regulations will give a priority for health care to severely disabled veterans and critical care needs. With the support of Congress, we can reduce waiting time, end long hours of travel, and give our veterans the comfort of local medical attention when needed. While our congressional appropriation falls short of the minimum $25.5 billion needed to maintain the current system, long waiting lines and all, we must convince our elected leaders that a crucial part of Homeland Security is to maintain and strengthen the VA hospitals and provide our veterans the optimum services in the nation. As a final consideration for local care, we seek the allowance for VA pharmacies to honor prescriptions written by private physicians of our veterans so they do not have to wait months to get an appointment at the VA facility in order to get essential medicines. Access to local medical care with the dollars following the veteran will make a positive difference in the lives of our most deserving veterans. We need to enhance our system to make this possible. House Joint Memorial 2 expresses our respect to our veterans and at the same time brings more efficiency and economy in their medical concerns. I thank you very much for your consideration, and I would like to submit at this time, if I could, Chair Cruz, a letter from John Roach III of Beaverton, Oregon. He's a life member of the Oregon Veterans Association, the Vietnam Veterans of America, and the Disabled American Veterans. And he says, please accept this letter as my personal testimony. I'm in support of Joint Memorial 2 to allow Oregon veterans to receive health care from health care facilities other than the Department of Veteran Affairs health care facilities. I am fortunate to live close to the Portland VA Medical Hospital. When I need to see a doctor between my regular doctor visits to receive care, I must go to the emergency room at the VA hospital. After talking to many veterans, I find the average time in the emergency room is approximately 4 to 6 hours before midnight, waiting time, doctor's visit, and waiting for medications. After midnight, the time frame can change to approximately 3 hours plus. For people that live a longer distance from the Portland VA hospital, this has become a nightmare when driving time is added to it. In regards to the dental clinic, after you qualify, which can take years for qualification, the waiting list is about 3.5 pages long. This is approximately another year and one half before receiving regular treatment. It's a shame for a veteran to qualify for a benefit and not be able to use that benefit after he or she has waited so long to qualify for this benefit. I hope that this letter will make the Oregon Legislature and the Congress of the United States aware of serious need for veteran care reform, and proper funding. And P.S., I'd like to thank and praise the doctors, nurses, nursing staff, and pharmaceutical staff at the VA for doing a tremendous job under extremely stressful and overworked conditions. They deserve our support and our deep appreciation. And, Mr. Chair, if I could point out that attached to my testimony and the individuals here today who will speak to it is an evaluation on January 20th, 2003 of veterans health care in the state. And Deborah Gill is here today to testify to this. And finally, I would just like to point out that when we drafted this bill, we had no real concept that we would be losing our doctors to the war on terrorism. And at this time, we are even more impacted than ever before by the loss of physicians. So this bill is more critical at this time, and I thank you for considering
it. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Nelson, will this program, would this program not also help our rural hospitals by providing federal funds there for the veterans, for example, from Eastern Oregon, so they could go to their local hospital? The local hospital would receive the federal funds, making it a more viable hospital in that community for everybody else as well.
Chair Cruz and Representative Barker, thank you for that question. I think it's an excellent avenue to explore. We do have the distinguished director of the Department of Veterans Affairs here today, and others are far more qualified to answer that question, and I'll leave that to them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your support.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I don't have a question. I just want to commend you for bringing this forward. The facts you're bringing are just shameful. It's outrageous that veterans are having to wait this long and when they've served their country and have every right to expect that they're going to be taken care of in their old age. Thank you.
Representative Tomei, thank you very much.
Any other questions? Representative Nelson, I suppose it would be correct to assume that when we pass this HJM that you would probably like to be the carrier?
Mr. Chair, I would be most honored to be the carrier.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Greg Warnock, H. McDonald, and John Mangus. We'll kind of tag team stuff here. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It is with great pleasure that I'm able to give testimony on behalf of Oregon Veterans Association. My name is Greg Warnock. I'm the executive director. Our offices are here in Salem, 495 State Street. Oregon Veterans Association supports HJM2, sponsored by Representative Nelson, for the same reasons as presented in the memorial, and because it seeks a common sense solution to the serious systematic problems found throughout the Veterans Health Administration's program. In many cases, military veterans who have suffered and sacrificed so much of their lives for our freedoms and liberties could be treated more expeditiously and efficiently if they were able to visit a local hospital or medical clinic for routine medical services. A veteran, for example, who lives in a rural community in central or eastern Oregon, or a veteran who lives more than a few hours away from one of Oregon's two VA hospitals, is forced to endure the burdens of extensive travel, sometimes while in pain or in trauma, and unreasonable personal expenditures of time and financial resources. Traveling for 2 to 5 hours and a waiting time of 4 to 9 hours for treatment is common. While VA hospitals provide far better care than they did even a decade ago, Oregon Veterans Association asserts that military veterans and their families deserve far better treatment than they are currently receiving. Americans' military heroes should be cared for and treated with more dignity. They deserve the very best level of care that our society offers. Oregon Veterans Association and its members request that the committee urge the members of Oregon's congressional delegation to consider new and innovative methods of effective medical care for our military veterans. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you.
I'm Mac McDonald, represent the VFW, Disabled American Veterans, Military Order World Wars, and the Salem Area Veterans. We support this bill because basically since World War II, the Disabled American Veterans have purchased vans and had drivers bring veterans to the veterans' hospitals or veterans' facilities. The drivers of these, most of the time, are World War II veterans. At the present time, we are having major difficulties obtaining drivers for these vans. Therefore, we cannot get them to the facilities that they need to get to. So this bill becomes, as time goes on, more important because we cannot get these veterans to the veterans' facilities that they need to get to. And we support this bill 100%. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Mangus, and I'm Director of Veterans Affairs for the state of Oregon. I'm here to support HJM 2. I would like to say that there are a couple of corrections to the bill on line 6, that the highest number of veterans per capita should actually be highest number of war veterans per capita. And the population of veterans in Oregon is really probably down in the 360,000. And rather than two Department of Veterans Affairs outpatient clinics in Oregon, there are nine in Portland, Salem, Eugene, Roseburg, Medford, Klamath Falls, Bend, Bandon, and Astoria. We do have two hospitals, Portland and Roseburg, and a domiciliary out in White City just outside of Medford. But we also are fortunate to have a federal VA medical center in Walla Walla that services most of northeast Oregon. And then the Boise Hospital picks up the basically the veterans over in the Malheur County area. What the memorial is actually driving at is what we called back in the late 70s and 80s was mainstreaming. And I think at that time, at least all of the Vietnam veterans were pushing for mainstreaming because we thought that it was almost impossible to receive adequate care based on timing or just even once you were in the system receiving what we would consider adequate care. And there was a big argument when the VA hospital in Portland was built, the new hospital in Sam Jackson Hill was basically a replacement hospital, and at that time there was a strong argument that that hospital not be built and that veterans seeking hospital care in Portland would be mainstreamed into a private physician. The VA basically has always, well, initially the VA hospital system was established to care for service disabled veterans, veterans coming home from service who were injured and required care for those injuries or injuries that were adjunct to their service-connected disabilities. And over the history of the system, those categories have changed, so then it expanded to what they call individuals with non-service-connected disabilities. And till today, when we've evolved into a hospital system that has eight categories for care, and with the first priority being those veterans who are rated 50% service disabled or greater, and then it goes down and includes ex-prisoners of war, individuals who had received the Purple Heart, individuals rated 30 to 40% service disabled, and so on. So we come down to Category 8, and Category 8 was really basically a veteran who had no service-connected disabilities but had served in the military service. And enrollment into Category 8 has now been suspended because the federal VA does not have the necessary resources in order to provide that care. And initially, I don't think they were ever prepared in order to take the influx of people who have applied to the VA for care in recent years. And a lot of that is the economics that's driving the system, whether it's the federal VA system or just private business. there's a need for medical care, and a lot of that is for the prescription drugs, whereas that's becoming a very expensive issue, especially individuals not having health insurance. The VA budget nationally for medical care is $20.5 billion. I believe the president just signed the budget finally since it was passed last October. And the Portland VA Medical Center piece of that budget is $902 million, which is a pretty substantial budget. VA medical facilities throughout the United States are divided into what they call VISNs, Veterans Integrated Service Networks, and our VISN is Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, and those are controlled through the office in Vancouver, Washington, at the Vancouver. It's actually part of the Portland Hospital now, but it's still Vancouver to the old. People have been around a while. And that money is administered out to the Roseburg Hospital, the Dom, and the other hospitals within that system. But Portland's share is $902 million, and that included in that as part of the capital expenditures. That's about a 7.5% increase over the previous year, but is yet inadequate to provide care for all veterans in the state of Oregon. I would guess, and I support mainstreaming, always have, because it's much easier to go to a physician within your local community if there is a physician available for your type of care. But I would guess that if the VA ever moved to mainstreaming just because of the costs of, that would be included in that, that we would be dropping back in our level of care to those individuals who are rated service-connected and probably for their service-connected disabilities. I don't know, but it would be a very expensive proposition. I guess that's all I'd like to say. Would answer any question, and I do support the memorial. I would say for Representative Westland's sake that the clinic in Bend was fought for years because of the guys having to make that trip over the mountain to try to get to the Portland Hospital. And Congressman Bob Smith fought for that for as long as I can remember. And when he finally did get the authority for that clinic, they never did attach funds to it. So it still just kind of languished there until they developed this outpatient community-based outpatient clinic program, and finally the Bend Clinic was established.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My greatest concern is then some of our veterans, like you were saying, if they're then going to cut back the level of categories, that then many of our veterans wouldn't be able to benefit at all from health care. Is that how I interpreted correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's just me talking, and that's what I'm guessing based on what, it's kind of like veterans benefits, whether at the federal or state level, has really never adequately been funded. And if we move to a system like that, I am just guessing that they would move through their priority system, which is for the service-connected veteran. The other problem you have with VA healthcare, that the VA healthcare system is the backup system to the Department of Defense. If we get into a shooting match in the Middle East and individuals are brought home for care, it's not going to be military hospitals that will be taking care of those. It will be VA hospital systems that will be receiving those individuals for care. That, again, will put a stress on that system.
Just follow. It'd be nice if this gets over the Senate side. Will this go to the Senate?
Yes.
Yes. That maybe another statement could be added that we want to make sure that all veterans are covered. I would hate to see any health care be denied.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that'd be fine. I think it's a good memorial as it is. But I would put the VA health care and treatment right up there with among the very best in the world. I know if I want, the VA hospital in Portland is probably one of the top hospitals for cardiac care, coronary care, that sort of thing. Cancer research, thanks to Mark Hatfield, it has one of the best cancer research facilities in the United States. They mentioned the liver transplant and that. I would mention that the individual who was taken by ambulance to Portland and then received the $1,200 bill, that is not unusual if the veteran is non-service connected and did not have entitlement for that. But if that veteran was service-connected and got that bill, I'd be more than happy to try to get that taken care of for that individual.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mankin, people in the upper categories, do they have to wait the length of time that Representative Nelson was talking about in her testimony?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, yes.
So they're all in follow-up. So they're all sort of put, all the categories are put into a pool, and it's first come, first serve, no matter if it was service-related injury that's bringing them to the hospital.
Just like you calling your doctor, you kind of fall into the next available appointment time. If it's an emergency, then the service-connected veteran, and they know it's a priority one, would have received treatment first, and they do have the first priority. But as a rule, if you're calling in for an outpatient visit and you call up the clinic here in Salem and want to schedule an appointment, they will schedule you at the next available time. That may be some time out with the demand that's, you know, that has existed since they went to that system. They actually went out and recruited. I mean, that was part of the problem, is they went out and they actually recruited people to enroll in a new VA healthcare system, and they recruited, and people came. And it's just like one big party. And as the economy went down, more and more people came, and it overloaded the system. And whether you're priority one or priority eight, there's a waiting list for you. Once in the system, it's great care. And I'm a Category 1 veteran, but I go to my own doctor, you know, and...
So I just follow up. I just want to make sure I understand, John, as you're saying then, a veteran who had been wounded in Second World War and Vietnam or whatever, and as this is the first time coming to the VA hospital, would have to wait just as anybody else would wait. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, if... That person, you know, you apply, you know, it's a funny system. You apply to have your disability rated service connected through what they call the VA regional office. And once that's done and you are, say, 100% service connected because of gunshot wounds, that doesn't do anything on the medical side at that point. Then you have to go to the medical side and apply for enroll in it, and you would be rated, say, priority one. If you needed care or emergency care, they would get you in. Or if you were diverted to a private hospital because of your service-connected disability, they would pay for that care.
If it were an emergency.
Right.
But if it were not an emergency, you would have to wait just as everyone else.
Generally, yes.
Thank you, John.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess probably as being one of the few veterans on this panel, I want to really protect the veterans and the Veterans Administration. We've seen the benefits of it at the Dom and in Medford, but as you point out, and I think quite clearly, for an emergency situation, you really need to be able to access immediate care and not have to take a 30-minute or a one-hour drive to the Dom or to Roseburg for a veteran. I, like you, see my own personal physician, but I'm concerned for those who are disabled and need care, not necessarily related to their disability, might be heart or other problems that require immediate care. My concern is a little different because I'm hearing from our local Independent Practitioners Association, the doctors who manage the care for the Oregon Health Plan, that in some cases there is duplication, and not that the duplication itself is bad, in that a patient may seek care from the local if they're covered with the Oregon Health Plan as well as veterans benefits. They may be indigent and qualify for both. But and not that it's not good to get a second opinion or have treatment from two different physicians, but where there is duplication, it can really confuse the care. And I think before we go to work session, I would like to see us be able to negotiate some way that a patient that, say, is being treated in a Roseburg or the Dom Portland in some way is encouraged not to shuttle back and forth between private care and veterans care and back and forth, because the doctors are having a hard time managing that case and getting the care really, the treatment really served well. But overall, I think we definitely need to offer you the care outside the hospitals, especially with a wartime situation coming upon us and possible overloading of your hospitals. And I accept any comment you have on that. I do have another question or two.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I take it you're from Jackson County area.
We're in Grants Pass.
Grants Pass. The domiciliary, you know, is probably the closest thing to what Oregon had as an old soldier's home for a lot of years, mm-hmm. But has turned now into an outstanding facility, primarily a lot of homeless individuals and individuals with maybe drug, alcohol abuse. Getting them into a program, take care of them, then get them into a voc rehab training program, and then teach them how, and they just kind of wean them from that system and back into the community and the system finding employment, and is tied in with, I think it's Rogue Community College at this time, having a program on campus out there. People using both systems.
To break in, we've lost some of our finest doctors in Grants Pass to the domiciliary.
Yeah.
So they're providing terrific care over there.
It's a great system. But, you know, when people, like you talked about the Oregon Health Plan and then the VA and guys moving back and forth, I think it's a human nature type thing. People are always looking for the best answer. And so they do shuttle back and forth, which is an expense to the state on the health plan side, and it's an expense to the VA on the other. I don't necessarily blame the individual, because if you're worried enough to be going to the doctor, you know, you want to know and you want to get cared for, but it's a financial burden. The access to the healthcare system truly is one of the reasons is to receive pharmaceuticals that a lot of people out of work, you know, so they're accessing the VA because it's such an expensive program anymore, and the system is overloading. You know, it's just, and if there is another war, guys start coming home hurt. You know, it's only, you know, Vietnam, initially they argued Agent Orange, you know, didn't do anything to human beings, you know, it just was out there as kind of a defoliant. Of course, it would take triple canopy jungle down to red dirt, and to argue that that didn't do something to the cell structure of a human being seemed kind of stupid, even to, you know, a layman. When in fact, now over the years, the VA and the VA denied any relationship. The U.S. Congress denied relationship. The Department of Defense denied it. The Center for Disease Control denied. Now all of a sudden, it's chloracne, it's a number of different cancers, prostate cancer and diabetes type 2 are directly related to that exposure. More and more Vietnam veterans are accessing the system just because of that. You know, and here, that's 40 years after the fact.
Can I follow up?
Yeah, let me make one point, Representative, and that the issue of third-party payer is being addressed in the bill. Sponsored by Senator Fisher, and it's pretty much separate and distinct from this memorial. So that issue will be addressed, but I don't want to confuse this issue with that.
Right. I was I was thinking more along the lines of facilitating the transfer records and the ability for both ends, both the Oregon Health Plan and the Veterans Administration doctors being able to transfer records and get the most effective care.
Right, but that will be addressed in another vehicle.
In the other bill?
This.
Okay. Second question, how does this impact the long-range health of the hospitals themselves? Will this be drawing away enough to impact the care or the quality of care?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, you're talking about if they were to mainstream veterans. I don't think there would be, in the long run, that much of an impact, because I imagine if they ever did anything like this, this would be on the side of primary care. If at the point that there was some type of a surgical procedure that was required as a direct result of those initial contacts, that they would probably require that those be done at a VA facility. I think the VA hospital system, as strained as it is, will exist because there isn't a better. It's the biggest healthcare delivery system in the world. And that's not saying it couldn't be better, and that and it's not saying that it's not stressed to the limits right now, but I don't think I think it'll survive, and it'll only get better over time.
Thank you.
I saw Representative Westland run off Girl Scout cookies.
I'd just like to thank you, gentlemen, for coming today and doing this. The VA system, I'm a veteran, and I've been appalled for some time at the lack of federal support as I see it. I know my father was a World War I veteran, and he actually died of cancer in the Portland hospital, but he just had nothing but the highest of praise for the care he got there while he was, you know, was fighting colon cancer at that time 40 years ago. And I just think it's a mispriority of our federal government the way they're treating our veterans here. And even though I'm not have no service disability, so it doesn't really directly affect me, I'm just appalled by the things. And I was a policeman in Portland for pretty much 30 years, and so I assisted many veterans who needed help up the hill and would get them up there, and they'd just be up there for hours and hours. And they were lucky that they could get in that soon, even. And I've talked to other veterans, World War II veterans, who applied, and they tell them, you know, like there's an 18-month wait or something to get started, and that's just inexcusable in the United States of America, in my opinion.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, that 18-month wait has been whittled down. The guy that's the director of the VA hospital in Portland is Dr. Jim Tuschmidt, and not only is he an MD, he's also an MBA. He understands the business side of it, and he did come up with some extra money that they worked on weekends, including him, calling these guys on the waiting list and getting them authorization to exactly what Representative Nelson was talking about, mainstreaming them, getting them into their own doctors for that initial entry examination. So it's cleaned up substantially, but there's still about 1,300 on the waiting list for the Portland Hospital. And to get into the Salem Clinic initially, you schedule that through Portland back to that clinic. And it's a good system, but it's strained to the limit. I'm glad your father received good care. It's kind of funny, you know, you think we still have about half a dozen World War I veterans in Oregon that are, matter of fact, the father of your former legislative council is, I think, 105-year-old World War I vet. But, you know, and entitled to receive care, that's still the cost of war. I mean, that's still being tacked on to the cost of World War I. Just think what it is. So if you don't like it, don't have it. You know, that's my feeling.
Thank you.
Okay. John, would you be willing to get together, number one, if it's the committee's pleasure? I know there are some technical errors in this resolution. It would be my intention to move it and make sure that we have absolutely everything correct over on the Senate side. So if you'd be willing to work with Representative Nelson to make sure, and with Sandy, so that she has accurate numbers in the SMS. And then, Representative Nelson, you can add that amendment on the Senate side just so we aren't bogging down the system with this. So, okay. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Deborah Gill and Richard McKnight. It's okay. I might have to move it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Deborah Gill. I am a 15-year veteran. My husband is a 7-year veteran. Both of us have service-connected disabilities. I have fortunately been in the system since I got my disability in 1996. My husband has had his disability since he got out in 1990, but never required VA care until recently, and he has been on the waiting list for 2.5 years. He's finally gotten an appointment in April to get a primary care physician, but has been unable to get any kind of medications, prescriptions, anything of that sort since then. I also am a work study for the Yamhill County Veterans Service Office and see these veterans come in every day requesting medical care, requesting disability pensions, and it's just... to see a World War II veteran come in and tell them, yes, we can do the paperwork, and yes, we can try to get you put into the system, but you're looking at a very long time before anything will get done. It's just, it's heart-rending. I've had just World War II veterans tell us that when they went to boot camp in the 30s and 40s, they were told that they would be taken care of for life, medically, through the VA, and they're coming in finding out this isn't so. When the new... the resolution came down in January 17th for the they basically put in a cap on anybody who was not service connected trying to get medical care. If they made too much money, then they don't get it. And this moratorium is for at least a year. It's just very heart-rending to tell some of these veterans and stuff that, especially a war veteran, that your chances of trying to get medical care at this particular point in time when they need the prescription care, especially with the way that the times are going in the Medicare situation, the Medicaid situation, and the way that the private insurances are increasing, that they have several hundred dollars worth a month worth of prescriptions that they can't afford to pay any longer. And they cannot get a prescription until they get a primary care physician. And it's just, this bill would be enormous help.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Please.
My name is Richard McKnight. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I'm rated at 40%, which puts me in Category 2, a priority. I have been waiting for over 2.5 years for a primary care physician. I'm a work-study student at the Yamhill County Veterans Service. I talk to many Vietnam vets all the time that have been waiting as long or longer, and we are getting more and more that are applying for medical benefits. VDIS rated service connected. That even just to get rated for service connected can take a year or longer. And then you're on the waiting list after that to get a primary care physician. I am in constant 24-hour pain because of my disability, and I cannot get any medical attention, even going to the emergency room at the Veterans Hospital. They won't do anything except give me drugs. I cannot take drugs. I'm an ex-drug addict. I have almost 3 years clean and sober, and I'm not going back where I came from. I'm trying to get my life straightened up. And there are many vets like me that we need special care and can't get it because we're on a, seems like an endless waiting list. I know of a couple that have been on that same waiting list for 6 years or longer. And it's ridiculous to somebody that has served their country, been injured and hurt while in active duty, and can't get anything because of their priority there that they have. And there's a limited primary care physicians, extremely limited primary care physicians. The ones that I know about in four different, there's only 18 in the four veterans clinics that I know about, and they're carrying a caseload of between 600 and 1,200 patients apiece, which means you get very limited care and takes a long time to get in to see them. And I think we need to open it up where vets can get a primary care physician that outside of the VA, because there's some of us that need constant care that was like me. I am constantly getting worse. I have degenerative joint disease, degenerative disc disease, arthritis, and it's getting worse and worse as every day goes by.
If I may add something, I had tried on Friday to call and get an appointment with my primary care physician, which is in Vancouver. And they can only schedule out 30 days at a time. I was told to call back this week to see if I could get in that next week of the 30-day period. It may take me several weeks to try to get an appointment that may be another 4 weeks out. I was just diagnosed with diabetes by my primary care physician in July. Due to my insurance increases from my husband's private insurance, I can no longer afford the testing that I need to have for my diabetes and need to have it done through the VA. If I can't get in to see him within a reasonable amount of time, then I go without the testing. So it's very, very, I mean, the bill is, I just can't say how much it would help.
Questions? Mr. Chair, when I was in 1961, they told me, now you've served, you know, you'll be eligible for lifetime medical care, even as late as 61. They're still saying that.
In 1980, they didn't tell me that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dennis Hoyman and Lloyd Abbott.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Dennis Hoyman. I'm a 100% disabled Vietnam veteran. And I'm going to testify about two other veterans that I work with and a little bit of what their case I have a problem with. I work with a lot of veterans on the outside where they fall in between the cracks, where they haven't qualified for their benefits yet. I will take them to their appointments when they can't. I had a particular gentleman that was 77 years old, and he lived out in Tillamook. And when I first met him, he was just waiting to die because he didn't have any medical care or was even aware he could get it through the Veterans Administration. He had something like $11,000 in his savings account, but his medications were running him approximately $482 a month. And his cost of living out there with his food expenses and everything, he was just depleting his $11,000. And he had it calculated out that he would live for 9 months and then he'd just have to die because he couldn't afford his medications. And when I first met him, I knew of some programs in the Veterans Administration that they would bring his level up to $750 income a month. Because his Social Security, I guess he was one of those notch babies, they called him, where he fell in between. He didn't get real good benefits for his Social Security. And the Veterans Administration brought him up to a $750 level, and then they would pick up his medications even though he was non-service connected. He just had a small copay. But he had to get, again, like everyone else, a primary care physician assigned to him out of Portland. And that took 6.5 months to get that done. And that was a little quicker because I knew a lot of the people up there and he was kind of streamlined. And I knew how to get him through the system rather than a regular waiting period. that was one veteran, like I say, just took a long, long time to get his care. He finally did end up passing away, but the Veterans Administration, because of the care, once he did get into the system, he was able to live for about another 6 years, and then just died of natural causes. I have another veteran I was taking care of, lives in Mount Angel. He is he was service-connected, and but he has no way of transportation. He's severely disabled and crippled. And the cost of him on a routine visit, because of where he lives in the outlying districts, for him to go in and even just get a medication change and his prescription refill was $950 to go on up to Portland to see his primary care physician, because they have to bring out a special ambulance because of his disability that can handle somebody with a wheelchair. And if he had the local doctor just be able to refill his prescription, rewrite a prescription, $35-$40 versus $950 just to haul him up to the hospital. But he's got to get up at 5 a.m. in the morning, catch this van that they have that they send down for him, and just to go get this prescription. He doesn't get home till 6:30, 7 o'clock at night just to get a prescription refilled. And that would be it on the on those two veterans there. And now I'll cover my own case, just a couple incidences of how it is, because they're so severely understaffed up in Portland. This was last year. I was having some chest pains, not feeling very good. I was dizzy. I got on a phone and called into what they call their emergency care thing. Explained my situation. They told me to come to the Portland VA. I was in the Portland VA for 9.5 hours. With chest pains, dizzy, all flushed and everything. The doctor that I finally did get to see in their emergency room didn't know that much about it, gave me a prescription for medications. I was waiting in line for the medications for a little over an hour, and when they finally called my name, I got up, started to walk across the room, and just passed out, I guess, because of the heart attack I was having. And then I finally got admitted to the hospital. But that's 10.5 hours. I'm sitting there having a heart attack, and they were going to send me home at first because I passed out on the floor from the pain. I finally got admitted to the hospital. I had my wrist, one of my war wounds from Vietnam, was my wrist has been replaced, and they replaced it many years ago with a plastic prosthesis. And we've been having problems with it. It's been deteriorated down to the point now that it's almost gone. And I've been waiting now just a little over 9 months for them to even go ahead and get an X-ray on this thing so we can go ahead and proceed with getting my wrist replaced. And it's only because of the understaffing that it's taking so long to get it. Because once you do get in the system and you do get treatment, the people up there are just great. We have great doctors. We have great nurses up there. But it's just that they're severely understaffed. We have a clinic here in Salem that has been in operation now for almost 2 years. But we cannot go down there and make an appointment with any of the doctors. We cannot call in. There isn't even a phone number that we can call down to this clinic if we're having a problem. We have to go through the VA in Portland to get these appointments. We have a problem with them coordinating the appointments down here. I have myself, and I'm not the only one, have received a letter from Portland saying, okay, your appointment was 2 days after I received the thing. I would receive it out of Wednesday in the mail, and my appointment was 2 days prior. And I have had another occasion, again, I'm not the only one on this, where they've made my appointment like on a Wednesday at 9 a.m., and they would tell me that, no, I'd get into the clinic at 9 a.m. for my appointment. They said, no, your appointment was at 8 a.m. Therefore, you're going to have to reschedule, and then we're looking at waiting another month to reschedule this appointment because there was a mistake in the coordination between making the appointments. And again, they say it's because of the understaffing. I'm not sure what it is, why these doctors down here cannot make their own appointments. It has to go through Portland. Representative Anderson had a question about this duplication of care and records. I am one of the few fortunate. I do have outside insurance that covers some of my medications and some appointments. And my doctor is more than willing to go ahead and we just sign a release, and they would send these over to the Veterans Administration, and then those are made part of. As long as the veteran would go ahead and tell us, your primary care physician or whoever you're going to see, I have another doctor that I'm working with, they will give you a release form. You take that to your normal doctor, and they're more than willing to, you know, no charge. Just go ahead and make that part of your record. And then that's run through your primary care physician up in Portland, and then it's put on the computers, and they have access to all of that no matter where you are in the VA system. Even if I went to Roseburg, they punch in my numbers on the computer, and it'll bring up all the records of any care I've had in the Veterans Administration anywhere. So I fully support this bill and would like to see it go through and get some funding and be able to get local care so I don't have to wait 9.5 months to get an x-ray or stand there having a heart attack waiting 9.5 hours because they're understaffed. So I thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify here, and if there's any questions, I'm ready.
Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's interesting and very helpful. And it goes both ways. If you get your doctor to release, his records can be transferred into the VA system, and the other way as well, so that your doctor, private care physician, can access the VA records and get those as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, they would not be able to get on the computer system to get in there.
But could get a copy.
Correct. There is no problem in sending it in, and they're very quick in responding back and forth that way. That they're really quick on.
Great. Thank you.
Please.
Thank you. Chairman, Representative Krause, and representatives, I won't take much of your time. I'm a 21-year active duty veteran of Korea and Vietnam. I'm military. Associate, you know, I get to care a few from the military activities and so on, but I want to give my total support to this bill, Representative Nelson, and I think it's wonderful. And the fellows from my own post and local area, Willamina, Sheridan, Grand Bond area, totally are in agreement with me.
Yeah, could you state your name for the record, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Lloyd Abbott, and
that's just a thing we have to do here.
Absolutely.
So. Okay.
And but I definitely go along with what the gentleman here just said. The time is a tremendous factor of getting in. Just recently, although I have a primary care person here in Salem, the last time it took me over a year to get an appointment with her because of the system, the time, and everything that it took. And there definitely could be a lot of cases that are so severe that we could lose some of our people in between time, you know, that whatever their need is that they get the care. So I definitely am entirely supporting Representative Nelson on this, and I will do everything I can within my own power and talking with my other veterans to support her in every way that I can. Now, I've known John Mangus here for a long time. I was the state commander of the Veterans of Foreign Wars at the time that we got this new VA hospital up in Portland, and as he had told you, it was a real nip and tuck situation. because they weren't wanting to renew that VA hospital. But we did get it. It's a magnificent place. The care that I've gotten there, when I've gotten there, was wonderful. Just absolutely great. I don't know how it could be any better. But there are so many people that it's really difficult to get in when you need to a lot of times. And the travel, it's definitely an hour and a half travel or better to get up there. I myself am an emergency driver that takes a lot of veterans up there, but it takes me at least an hour and a half to get them up there. And sitting behind me here where I was at, there were two other past veteran drivers, both World War II veterans, that they just got where they couldn't do it anymore. So having enough veterans, volunteers, to drive these vans back and forth is a real, it's getting to be a real emergency. And I would like very much to see something like this. I think it would help our veterans tremendously. And I have, anyway, you have my full support. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on HJM2 and open a work session on HJM2. Representative Dalto.
Mr. Chair, I move the House Joint Memorial 2 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Very good. Representative Dalto moves House Joint Memorial 2 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
I think this is a wonderful first step, but it is so frustrating to me, Mr. Chair, and I would say this to Representative Nelson, too, that this, I'm not sure what good this is going to do, and I wish there was something more concrete that we could do with the federal government to make sure that these veterans are served. I'm not sure what kind of effect this will have. If there's something else that maybe we can do as a body to encourage our congresspeople, our senators, to do something in Washington, D.C. to follow up on this, that would be really helpful.
Yeah, and Representative, that is part of the frustration that because Congress is what it is and we don't have any authority over them, but I guess I would say that making the statement is better than not making
absolutely.
It. So,
absolutely. Absolutely.
Seeing no further discussion, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Dalton?
Aye.
Representative Monson?
Aye.
Representative
Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Weston?
Excused.
Chair, please.
Aye. House Joint Memorial 2 and Representative Nelson will carry. House Joint Memorial 2, having received the constitutionally required majority, is declared passed. And before I close the work session, Representative Nelson, you are going to be drafting the amendments, and it will probably be appropriate in your speech to make reference to the corrections. So, on the floor, just so the record on the floor is totally accurate. So, thank you very much. We'll close the work session on HJM2. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2287 and House Bill 2288. Simply because they're the same bill except for one little piece. So, and Jacqueline, James, John. Okay, I know you're. You're in Senator Winter's committee, and I appreciate you being here. Please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jacqueline Zimmer-Jones, Director of the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. And we're here to talk to you this morning about what we, House Bill 2287 and 88, which we call sort of equity. That's what we've sort of given it as a nickname over the years. And what I'm going to do, I'm sorry, I'm double parked this morning. I'm actually supposed to speak in another committee as well. So I'm going to turn this over to John Mullen from Clackamas County. He's quite impacted by it and quite able to speak to it. and then James Tay. So, but I will, if you have questions after this over, most certainly track me down. I'd be happy to get them answered for you. Okay.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Mullen. I'm the director of Clackamas County Social Services, and I'm here today to represent the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disability. I know the committee has received a number of documents, including the document that was distributed this morning from O4AD, and rather than taking your time to read through that particular piece of testimony, what I just want to say is that I've been around since 1981 when the legislation was created to give local government the opportunity to take over long-term care programs, eligibility programs, and the like. And basically what happened with the passage of that bill back in 1981 is that there was a good faith effort, in fact ORS 410 speaks to this, about making sure that local government was not expected to put up money to fund these programs, but in fact the programs were to be funded on a par with the state programs. And to that effect, what had happened over the years, the first few years of this transfer, is that the staff that were transferred from the state to the localities were tracked in the state's personnel system, and so there was a certainty that we were being treated on a par with the state offices. In the middle 80s, there was a change in this because the state wanted to show on its books a reduced number of employees, and in fact it did make some sense because the employees were no longer employed by the state. However, the formula that was set up was attempting to keep that good faith effort to make sure that local government wouldn't be harmed by this. Now, as the years went along, there were a number of glitches to the formula, and some of those are discussed in the paper, but what had happened is that by the time the 1999 session rolled around, Clackamas County was in the worst shape of all of the transfer agencies. We were receiving about 83 cents on the dollar. In other words, 83 cents compared to the state getting a full dollar for their staff. We were in a position where we would have to look at turning the programs back to the state if we didn't get any relief. And in fact, in the 1999 session, there was some relief and brought us all up to about 92.3%, if I recall correctly. So there was change in the 99 session that really helped to sustain the programs. And now where we are headed, if there is no change in the formula, the 2003-2005 biennium, it's calculated by the Department of Human Services in a recent report back in May, that we would be at about 84.8% of equity. So basically what we are encountering each biennium is without a fix in this formula and without relief from the legislature, we wind up in a situation where we continue to lose ground. And so before you are two different bills, and they have a little bit of a different function. First of all, House Bill 2287 fixes the methodology and then puts the money into the bill as well. And there's a blank there because the dollar amount has to be calculated. And then House Bill 2288 is simply to change the methodology. So this is, for those of you who were involved in the last session, these bills were exactly as they were, and also actually the session before, these are the same bills that correct the methodology and add money. We did them the same way. One of the things that I would mention about the methodology that we've come up with that's in this bill is that we did a study that began in Clackamas County that then was done statewide and then was reviewed by the Department of Human Services, by the Department of Administrative Services, and by the Legislative Fiscal Office. And everybody agrees that it's a reasonable way to look at a methodology for equity. And so really now all that is needed is to really have the power and authority granted by this body to implement the formula and to grant the dollars for the Type B area agencies on aging. And in closing my remarks, I would just say that we've enjoyed really a terrific partnership with the state, and particularly in recent months with the change at the Department of Human Services. We have a very, very good working relationship, even though we're facing our most challenging time because of the cutbacks in services. But basically what we have done in the state of Oregon is so well regarded around the country, it's referred to as the Oregon model. And I know committee members have received a copy of O4AD's piece on the Oregon Oregon Way, which talks about what we're able to do locally by combining our efforts and combining our resources and making the best things happen for the local level. So basically all we are asking is to be treated on a par with the state offices, and that will conclude my comments, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, John. Any questions? Thank you.
Madam Chair, James Taves from the Department of Human Services Senior and Disability Programs. And I'll be very brief because we touched on some of these issues last week when we did the overview on the Senior and Disability Program. We don't disagree that equity is a good policy and one that we need to implement, and the obvious response at this point in time is it's not in the governor's budget. But having said that, we have agreed with the area agencies on aging that we need to go back, we need to reconstruct an equitable formula and update that formula on a regular basis, and then try to figure out a way incrementally or on some kind of basis to begin to move us closer to an equitable formula. And it particularly is important, and again from the comments last week, if we are to increase the way we efficiently manage local programs across the state and move towards more of a uniform or consolidated model, the equity issue is one of the big stumbling blocks in doing that. And that's why we've sort of had this patchwork of local different kinds of area agencies on aging, because we haven't been able on a global basis to really resolve the equity issue. It's a problem that also extends to other areas where we do business with local government and county mental health programs, county developmental disability programs, where we're really doing functions government to government. And if state government doesn't do it and local government does, and then in the budgeting process we turn around and we treat local government like subcontractors, and we simply grant cost of living increases and not recognize that the personnel costs and the other administrative costs at the local government level escalate almost in the same way they do at the state level. And that's where we start creating this gap over time, because originally when we transferred these programs, they were obviously on par. And then over the years, as you simply do cost of living increases and not sort of a government-to-government transfer, it's where we start falling behind. So we've agreed, notwithstanding the bill, that we will sit down with the AAA, we will reconstruct the formula and try to get everyone's buy-in and what it should look like. The big issue, of course, is funding it, and funding obviously is not in the current governor's recommended budget.
Questions?
Yes.
Yes, Senator Tomei.
Thank you. James, so what does the governor anticipate will be happening to people who are served by these programs that are going to be inadequately funded?
Mr. Sherman, Representative Tomei, as John said, on a percentage basis, the transfer AAAs continue to lag progressively farther behind. The worst case scenario for us would be that local AAA simply give the business back to the state and say we can't cover our costs and therefore we're giving it back because we don't have adequate dollars in the budget to manage it on the state side either. And so our hope, there's nothing in equity. We had two budget policy packages way back when we were beginning the budgeting process, one to move towards equity up to 90% and a second one to 95%. Those, of course, fell away very early in the budgeting process as we looked at the deficit. So I guess I can only say we hope that the AAAs will hang on, that they'll work with us, and that we will come up with a formula, and over time we'll be able to close that gap. But in the interim, we're at risk if, in fact, any of the AAAs would truly hand the program back to the state.
Well, so interim, James, tell me what you see as the interim period that you just mentioned.
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, I think we can quickly reach agreement if we really roll up our sleeves together with our local partners. I think we could quickly reach agreement on what an equitable formula ought to be. I don't see that, and part of the bill deals with the formula and the methodology by which we get to that. And I think there's legitimate concerns by the AAAs that we've sort of ignored that or not come to the table in recent years to really update that formula. So I don't think that's the issue. We can agree on a methodology. The big issue is how we're going to fund it, given that not only at an administrative level and at a staffing level we're falling behind, but obviously programmatically we're taking such deep cuts at this point. So I really don't have a good answer for the interim. I certainly don't think in the current budget climate that we'll have any recommendations for the coming biennium, whether we can in the subsequent biennium. I think will depend on where we're at that point.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and thank you. And I guess, James, the purpose of these bills, I mean, they both go to Ways and Means, and it would certainly fit in the scope of Senator Winters and how they craft this thing. So it will be the intention of this committee, because my understanding is Senator Winters would like to have these bills, that we will bring them back and send them down there just more or less as tools for them to go through what's going to be an excruciating process on the Human Services sub. So any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much. We will close the public hearing on House Bills 2287 and 2288, and we are adjourned.